Chatter on Books. It's Cliff Notes for book clubs. Why read the book if you can listen to Chatter on Books? I'm Jamie McIntyre, your announcer. But you don't care about that. Here again is your host, Tori Clark.
Welcome back to Chatter on Books. No, I am not Tori Clark. I'm Claude Jennings. Tori, David, Jamie, and myself, we're so excited to see each other that we just like kind of jumped into the show without like an official intro and an official welcome to the show. And so this is your official welcome to Chatter on Books for this week. We just jumped into the show, started talking, and then the author joined us, and then the show just kind of happened. And so consider this your official welcome to Chatter on Books. We will now join the show, already in progress.
Should we talk a little bit about books?
Yeah, why not?
Okay. David and I traded texts last week about this. We have to just continue to rave about two of our, really, we love all our authors, but two of our favorites.
Yeah, we've started the show already, apparently.
Yeah, of course.
You know, it was news to me too, but I was having the same realization.
Evidently, we've been doing the show for the last 17
minutes.
We're
in the show. Okay, that's it. On with the show.
Finished Chatter on Toys, the 1980s, and we're moving on. Okay, and they keep popping up, right, David? Nana Kwame Brunya Ache, Chain Gang All-Stars, phenomenal. Ilion Wu, Master Slave, Husband, Wife. So now everybody does these, and I have an idea. Everybody does these year-end best of lists, best of everything in 2023.
Well, it's not a person. It's an animal. It's joined us. Did you see the animal join us, Tor?
Yeah, my cat was walking across the keyboard. I had to tell her to get down.
Offended by the grandchild?
Yeah, I don't know.
Taking over space.
She's a cat. There's no way to know.
So two fabulous books, and now it's Time Magazine, NPR, New York Times. I'm probably missing one, but they are repeatedly, both of them, showing up on these best of 2023 lists, which I think is fantastic. And they're spectacular people, great writers, really good, I think, important books, but they weren't around. You didn't see or hear that much from them until they were on Chatter on Books. I'm just saying.
I think you can totally take credit for it, Tor.
Totally.
Correlation often is causation.
I just got to say in this case, but it makes me think I would never want to do it because I might hurt somebody's feelings. But as you know, as a Chatter on Books season rolls, we should maybe we do it privately behind the scenes. Which books, like halfway through the year, say, okay, which books that we, you know, we've had the authors on, do we think might be on these lists?
Yeah.
Because I honestly believe if when we were talking to those authors and reading those books, if somebody had asked me, I would have said, yeah, I think this ends up over there. I really do. I thought,
sure.
Okay. Did anybody have guesses as to the most popular books to steal in high school?
Today? Well, I read it and I wouldn't have thought any of those books would be stolen. That was very interesting, wasn't it?
Jamie, did you have time to read?
I did. And I thought, first of all, I thought every book they stole sounded like one I'd like to read.
Yeah, right.
Even though I was thinking, well, high school, what would they have stole? I don't know.
Right.
Okay, so I wasn't familiar with any of the Diary of a Wimpy Kid. My son had that one. And there was a balloon for it in the Thanksgiving Day parade. So that one I knew, but most of them I didn't know, but they all sounded great. It's like you almost want to get the most stolen book collection all in like a boxed set.
What a great collector's edition.
Yeah, that you could just
that would be interesting.
Did you ever steal a book from your high school library?
Well, hold on a sec. Hold that thought.
Okay.
So I know I have to give credit to Book Riot. I'm not really sure what bookriot.com is, but they come up with fun stuff and fun trends. And that's where I saw this. The 16 books most commonly stolen from high school libraries. And when I said the headline, I saw the headline, I went, I'm just so happy people want books in any form or shape or fashion in high school. So if they're stealing them, I take this as a good sign.
Mm-hmm.
And disagree, discuss among yourselves. So this is Book Riot. This particular article is by Nikki DeMarco. This came out in November of this year. And please hold. The categories I also thought were really interesting. So the categories are mystery. Hold on. I'm using real paper here, people. Poetry. Who knew?
Yeah.
And, Claude, you got to help us because you're under 95. Mm-hmm. Manga and graphic novels? I know graphic novels. M-A-N-G-A, Japanese graphic novels?
That's a Japanese I think it came from anime.
How do we pronounce it? Manga or manja?
Let's see.
I'm not going to look up. Okay, but I do think people in high school tend to have a sense of humor. So under the mystery category, Stolen by Lucy Christopher.
Yeah. Yes.
I think that's funny. And that makes me think, is there some kind of crazy scavenger hunt where they're not really stealing?
Kidnapping. That's not the whole barrel of laughs.
But I'm thinking there was a scavenger hunt, steal books.
Oh, I see. Irony. Yes, got it.
Yeah, irony. high school students are ironic. One of Us is Lying. I've heard of that book before, so that's pretty cool. Mm-hmm. Like, We Were Liars, so that's good. Poetry. Again, I was shocked that they're stealing books of poetry, but I think that's a good sign.
Yeah.
One of the most popular ones, The Rose That Grew From Concrete by Tupac Shakur, makes me want
his poems and stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, which I thought was great. Kind of surprised. Who's the poet laureate, the wonderful poet laureate that spoke at Biden's?
Yes, I know. I see her.
Amanda.
Amanda Gorman.
Gorman?
Yes.
I was a little surprised they weren't stealing her books. And to this day, the only poetry that I have read and then occasionally gone back and reread in the last, 50 years without a gun held to my head is her stuff, which is pretty amazing. So, okay. Claude, did you find out the pronunciation?
Yeah, by the way, it is manga and it's Japanese comics and graphic novels.
Okay, there we go. So Assassination Classroom. Again, that kind of makes sense. That's what they're stealing. But I think it's great that they're stealing at all and they want to read these at all. And then, as Jamie mentioned, Diary of a Wimpy Kid, which I never read. Claude, you're younger. Did you read Diary of a Wimpy Kid?
No, but my son Manny is in love with Diary of a Wimpy Kid. He's got probably six to seven in that series that he just reads. And as growing up as a kid, I didn't read a whole lot. And so I love hearing him laugh in his room. And I just kind of sneak in to see what in the world is this kid, what video game is he playing? What is he watching on television? What YouTube thing? And he's just got the book open. He loves that series. And so when we go to book fairs, he looks for the latest one that he doesn't have. And so, he loves Diary.
What I really loved about this was this article was one is it revealed. Well, first of all, the idea that kids today, and I say kids, but
young
people today are so enamored of books that they would steal them.
Exactly.
It's amazing. Yes. And then the dirty little secret that he revealed was that they actually have a budget to replace stolen books.
Yeah.
So it's like it's built. It's like, companies that, factor in shrinkage, of their inventory.
Right.
That in the library. And it's kind of like a feature, not a bug. So a number of our popular books are going to get stolen and we'll just buy new ones and they can get stolen again.
I think it's great. Okay.
It also made me feel less guilty about the book or two that I stole when I was in high school.
So. Yeah. What did you steal
and why did you steal?
Well, I still feel guilty about to this day, but I stole. What's the statute of limitations on this? Because I don't want to get charged again.
Yeah. In chatter world, hard to tell.
I'll just say generically, it was a reward. It was a handbook on photography.
There you go.
And I felt guilty about it because I really wanted the book and I loved it. And it was like a Bible to me. But every time I had it, I thought, some other student is being deprived of this book because I've taken it. I think I checked it out and just never returned it. I might have just not checked it out. It's a long time ago. It's back before the turn of the century.
Huh. And do you still have it? Is it in your house somewhere?
I believe it is. So I could return it now. But of course, it's all about darkroom techniques and developing film. And
that's coming back. It's coming back.
And the other book I had, and I can't actually remember where I got it, but I also don't remember how I lost it, was the book, which I really loved, was called Steal This Book
by
Hoffman.
Yeah.
Great fun read about how to just basically scam the system for one of his suggestions was if you needed a new pair of if your shoes were really ratty, go to a bowling alley, turn your shoes in, get the bowling alley shoes, which were these like brightly colored shoes with a number on the back, and then just walk out with those and then you got a great pair of shoes. He was full of useful advice. Like
useful advice. David, have you ever stolen a book or anything else?
Again, the word steal is doing a lot of work there. I know I checked out a library book, but it was for class. And I was going to return it. And I just, you know, stuff happened. Things happen. You know, stuff happens. And you get busy. Okay.
And Tori?
I want to be honest about it. It was The Chosen by Chaim Potok.
Oh, that's a good one.
It was a good one. I liked the book and I wanted to read it again. And I've just been slow to.
So we're thinking the quality of the book reduces the criminality behind the theft.
Right. Exactly. If it's great literature, I mean, who can blame you?
Claude,
you throw yourself on the mercy of the court, right. But you're on
Claude,
it.
Claude, this was a terrific
book. What was I to do?
I don't think we should put Claude on the spot.
Well, let's leave it to books. We won't talk about other things, but okay. In high school, I did check out what was my favorite book, The Count of Monte Cristo.
And never returned it.
Yeah. I love that book so much because, you know, I try to be as nice as possible. There's such something about the revenge factor and getting back at someone after years and years of resentment that resonates with me. Although I would never do it myself. I live for those moments. Like my favorite Kobe Bryant moment is when he won his fifth championship and someone asked him, Kobe, what does this fifth championship mean for you? He says, I have got one more than Shaq. See, I want to be that kind of spiteful person.
You want pettiness in your life.
It's just not in me. And I try to be a nicer person than that. So that's my favorite book. I try to read it, you know, I try to read it once every 2 years or so, but yeah. So
I think instead of, you know, like, you know, raking myself over the hibachi for not, you know, returning this book years ago, I think the best thing to do would be to make a contribution to the library where you took the book out so they could replace stolen books. A stolen book contribution. Use this money to replace books that students have stolen because we actually applaud them.
Exactly. I think that is a great idea.
They should write book reviews on the books they stole. I think this would be a great idea.
That's a great idea.
I don't know for sure because I don't have the book, but I've been told that the plot of the book was.
So great. Okay, so as often happens with these sorts of topics, and I think about asking you guys and putting you on the spot, and I think to myself, yeah, I got nothing on that. But as we've been having this conversation, this image is coming to mind.
Yes.
Like, David, were you on Tony's show at the time? There was a great news story. It was a few years ago about somebody who was overserved in a bar and his 11-year-old son ended up driving him home.
I vaguely remember that. Yes.
Okay. Well, everyone was completely outraged and, oh my God, this is terrible. It's awful. And I was saying, this is terrible. Awful. And yes, for anybody familiar with Tony's show, Nigel sends you in the morning. He sends you a few notes saying these are kind of, and I'm reading, going, oh my God, that's terrible. That's awful. And literally, as we're sitting there with whatever cramped little radio station we were in, David, they're talking about it. All of a sudden, stuff started surfacing. And my father, God bless him, who was the most conservative, careful guy in the world, was overserved one night by some of his steelworker patients. Most of his patients worked in steel mines, coal mines, et cetera. And my sister and I happened to be out. Long story short, I was 12 years old at the time, had never driven a car in my life, and drove the car home 10 miles.
There you go.
Can I just say,
cinder block to your foot to get to the roots?
It was a Volkswagen Beetle, red, and we went in first gear all the way home.
The whole way.
So can I just say I love that term, overserved? I'm going to
overserved.
Mm-hmm. And I come home and my wife says, you know, where the hell have you been? And I'm like, honey, I was overserved.
I've been overserved.
And I had to call an Uber.
Exactly.
And we have to go back and get my
car. It wasn't
my
decision to be overserved, by the way. Someone made me drink all those drinks.
Exactly. So. He would have been disrespecting his patients if he hadn't taken all those Boilermakers from him.
Absolutely.
Thank you. Okay, we'll come back to Rick Reardon by the book next time because our author is here now, Ann Foster.
And she's wondering, who the hell booked me on this show?
No, everybody needs to sit up straight, pay attention, because she's an important, smart person. We are not. And she's got a really important book on a really important topic. And it's, I knew enough about this topic, the long war on drugs, to be dangerous. And it is really important. It is so multifaceted, so complex. And as I'm reading every page, I went, oh my God, I forgot about that. Oh my God, that's another consideration. It's really hard. It's really complex, but I'm glad we're doing it. And we're doing it because David goes way back. So David, introduce Ann Foster, please.
Oh gosh, this yeah. is now I'm nervous.
Yeah.
All right, I've said this many times. Anne's the smartest person I actually know. Like, I don't know the lady that is in Mensa. What was her name? Marilyn Vos Savant or whatever.
Vos Savant, yeah. Yes.
I know of her, but I don't know her. I don't know her personally. But of all the people I actually know, Anne's the smartest person I actually know. And we've been friends. Don't shake your head. It's true. We've been friends for a very, very long time since we both were at freshman at American University. And she's brilliant. And I'm glad she could be on the show. So my friend, Anne. I'm not going to be objective, by the way. She's my friend. So,
Chatter, we're not objective about anything. Anne, welcome to the show. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. It's an honor to be here. And David is the smartest person I know. So there you go.
You have both got to get out more if that is the case.
Yeah.
You need to widen your circle of friends.
Exactly. Yeah. Like, I can't be the standard for anything.
You really do. Okay. And we are going to spend a ton of time on your book because it really is important and meaningful and all those things and so complicated, but we would like to spend usually at this part of this, it's the, you know, like backstory on the author. Cause we'd like to know more, where are they from? Where they grow up? What they want to be when they're five? What books did they steal, et cetera. But all we really care about, because we all know that you are one of David's dearest, I won't say oldest, but dearest, oldest friends, clearly the smartest. What do we need to know about David as a freshman in college?
David as a freshman in college in many ways is exactly like David at age whatever he is now that I won't say, which is exactly the same age as me.
38, 39.
He has an eight in it. That's right. He was impressed us all from the minute we met him because he knew a lot of things, and he also could, in college, write a newspaper column in 20 minutes to the exact word count needed for the newspaper.
That's every week. Cool.
Every week.
Yeah. That's
and we were all trying to put trip. The paper. Well, we were trying to put the paper to bed in time to get to the bar before it closed, and so David. It all hinged on whether David could write, 12 inches about whatever he had decided.
If only they'd had a Pulitzer Prize category for that skill,
there should be.
He would have like a wall.
I was very much motivated by getting to last call. I'm going to be perfectly honest with you.
Well, otherwise, sure we had to go to Steak and Egg, and that's just not,
Bar.
Well,
what was the bar of choice then? When you were waiting for David to finish,
we would go to the original Chevy Chase Lounge.
Yeah. Oh, nice. It's
Fern Bar Chevy Chase.
Sure. Lounge. Yeah.
The original actually had a pirate, a guy who dressed like a pirate. He was in there every Thursday, and that was his thing. And can we get you anything?
Great.
Bluebeard? Anything? No, you're good. So that was we did that, and then there was another bar that had a bartender that had two different names. So that was a weird one.
Awesome. Have either of you been to Steak and Egg lately? Or Jamie or Claudia, you been to Steak and Egg lately? It's on Wisconsin Avenue. For those of you
still
in our world listening
God
to the show,
still there.
If you're in the DMV, you know it's there. It's kind of upper Wisconsin Avenue between Tenley and Friendship Heights, I guess.
Yep.
And was a total dive, but you haven't been there recently because they have they've had a total upgrade.
Really?
Yeah.
Is it very shishy now?
Very sad.
Do they have white tablecloths?
It's a
guy comes around with like a napkin over his arm and says, "Is there anything else?"
What's between horrifying and shishy? Because it's somewhere between horrifying and unhealthy and shishy. But they have the same signage, kind of the same brand, which is good. But it's definitely spiffed up, and they really stepped up during the pandemic. And now they have a lot of outdoor seating. Brian, my husband goes there a lot. That's one of his places he goes for breakfast with pals.
Yes. Yeah. You got to go there and get the eggs and the hash browns. It's just
not to
4:30 in the morning after you've had seven beers. It's fantastic.
Yeah, not to derail the conversation, but when I worked at WTOP Broadcast House at 40th and Brandywine, we would frequent the Tenley Inn. Did you ever go there? And of course, the Dancing Crab.
Dancing Crab, of course.
Yeah. Which was right behind our studios. And when we would open the windows in the summer, the detritus from the previous evening's crab service would be filling the dumpsters. And I'll just leave the description there.
Exactly. So,
hey, Claude, to add to our stable of podcasts, chatter on restaurants that are now closed.
Right. Yes.
Okay, and I do want to dive into this because I know just enough about the war on drugs to be dangerous. And I'll tell you what my experience is. The many, many, many jobs I've had in my life, and I've had a lot, and I've loved them all, fabulous people, fabulous work. I had 6 months at the Justice Department a long time ago, Reagan administration. I was 10. I was the youngest person working in the Justice Department. And I was working on something at the time that was called the President's Initiative on Organized Crime and Narcotics Trafficking, designed to investigate, prosecute, and ultimately cripple organized crime. Now, this is the pop quiz. Who was mastermind, thought leader, et cetera, behind this effort, who then went on to have a stratosphere career and now is not having a stratosphere career?
Wow. That I don't know.
Wow.
Well, I know it's not George Santos.
Correct.
Although I think he claimed that on one of his.
Maybe. Could have been.
Keep track. Yeah. Okay. It will take, you'll never guess it. Rudy Giuliani.
Oh, yeah. I should have guessed that.
Actually, I might have guessed that if you'd given me another half an hour.
Yeah, I should have.
But yes. The piece on which I worked, which is really using the term loosely, was the Governor's Project, which was designed to increase awareness and appreciation and efforts on behalf of the country's governors to interdict drugs at the border. Mm-hmm. It was primarily focused on Florida.
Right.
A lot of drugs were coming into the country through Florida at the time.
Fly them all in then, yeah.
Yes. And, God, there's so many stories I could tell, which I won't.
Because we have this author and she's written the book.
Really, a book about this very subject. What a coincidence.
Subject. But anyways, I'm an idiot. No, I'm an idiot. I was an idiot. I was a bigger idiot then. But I would sit there every day going through all this stuff and all this information. And my job was to compile it and whatever. And they would send it off to the governor's office. And I just kept looking at it going, well, okay, geography, if we're going to, tighten it up around Florida, they're just going to go over there and go, and that's what happened.
Louisiana, Mississippi.
Okay, but talk about the forward, because this gets us into your book, The Long War on Drugs, which is fabulous. Talk about your dedication to the book, because that explains why this book and why now and why you. So talk about your students.
So I teach a course by the same name, and I teach at Indiana State University, which is only famous for one thing. Which also connects to David because that's Larry Bird and basketball. Larry Bird went there. So, but our students are, pretty set of diverse, interesting students. And I teach this class to the general education. So it's all kinds of people who are going to be nurses and people who are going to be police officers and all kinds of people. And so there was no textbook. So I wrote one for them. And this is it.
And they helped you along the way.
They helped me along the way. I had nursing students who explained how drugs, actually work as medicine. I had criminal justice majors who talked to me about the law, all kinds of stuff. I had history majors who, told me things that they had read that I needed to maybe read. And yeah.
Right. And David's been helpful on this book, correct?
David was my educated, intelligent, ignorant reader.
Oh, that's a little harsh. Just a few minutes into your appearance here on Chatter on Books. But okay.
He didn't know anything about it. So he was ignorant. So perfect reader.
Yeah.
Perfect. And also, of course, I always strive to write as well as David. So if he gives me a thumbs up, then
that's pretty good.
You are more than adequate in that area.
Yeah. And I bet Anne would have done just fine because it really is. It's this, and I mean this is the highest praise. It's a really easy read. You can't stop. Okay, Anne, should we start with statistics? Just talk to us about some of the numbers, drug deaths, et cetera. Should we start with that?
Sure, we can start with that. So probably most of you have heard recently deaths from drug overdose, in the U.S. have hovered around 100,000. And as early as the mid-2000s, it was half that. So we've really increased dramatically in the last few years, and we can lay that primarily at the foot of fentanyl, but also the pandemic dramatically increased overdose deaths. People used by themselves a lot more. Although we also are better at counting drug overdose deaths now. So it's possible that there were more of them in the past.
Right.
Usage of drugs is actually up a bit in some categories like marijuana and opioids, but down in other categories. So kids are not using cocaine anymore or anything like that. That's kind of interesting.
Yeah.
Not sure what other statistics are interesting to you, but the drug deaths are alarming and those will continue to go up, I'm sure.
Because one of the things that struck me about your book was when I saw the title, I immediately thought, well, this is going to be a book that tells me why the war on drugs has been a failure. And it'll be starting to make that argument, you know, right away. And what I found in your book was, and I mean this as a compliment, is that it was basically a lot of factual information that wasn't overlaid with any sort of political agenda. It was, it took us through the history, and it really is a history book, yeah, of drug use by humans, you know, over the centuries. And it basically just gave you the facts to sort of come to your own conclusion without sort of hammering you over the head with it. And I think a lot of us who are at my age, and I'm, you know, in my, I've made it into my 70s, have a lot of firsthand knowledge about how the war on drugs had unintended consequences and sometimes really terrible consequences. And in often cases, it's because we have firsthand knowledge about people who were adversely affected. So my question, I guess, is after we absorb all these facts, what are we to think about the war on drugs, how it started, what it is today, and what are the lessons that we might take from that?
I see you want
a pretty heavy question.
Yeah, we'd like the answers now.
Please solve the drug problem.
Right, we'll do it now. What the heck? So I'll start. I mean, I read all those books that have that, you know, sort of alarmist or whatever kinds of critiques and that really want to tell you what to think. And all of them are too simplistic, right? So, because the drug problem is complex. So what I wanted to do was try in a simple way to uncover this complex problem. But that kind of then doesn't allow you a lot of room to at the end give the 5-point solution, that's your conclusion of how we're going to solve it. Also, partly because this is for students, I want them to come up with their own solutions because they're going to be the ones who go out in the world and solve this, right? So the nurses and the police officers and all those people, politicians, they're going to be the ones who create the solutions. And the solutions are going to have to, there's no easy solution. That's the problem. There's no easy way to do it. People will take drugs. They will, no matter how many laws you make against it, no matter how long you send them to prison for, they will continue to do it because they've done it since the beginning of time and they're not going to stop. Mm-hmm. And the main thing that we need to figure out as a society is what do we value about how to prevent the harms of that? And how are we going to do that? I have my own ideas. So my ideas would be along the lines of harm reduction, that try to make drug use safe so that we can help people not use in the future. Mm-hmm. Obviously, the other thing we should do is probably prevent people from using drugs. So the thing I didn't put in the book, but which I talk about with my students is, please don't use drugs until you're over 21. That doesn't make me the cool professor, but
it's there when your ratings rate my prop. Exactly. Write down.
But, you know, if you use drugs when you're young, your brain gets rewired and you're more likely to be having addiction issues in the future. If you wait to use drugs, any drug, including tobacco, until you're after 21, you're more likely to be able to handle it.
Yeah. Let me pile onto something Jamie said. And then, and David, I want to ask you something because you are the ignorant reader on my.
I am.
I meant that in the nicest way, by the way.
In the nicest way. But Jamie pointed out something really important about the book, The Long War on Drugs, which is, and you walked, it's like a 360 degree view of it.
Yeah.
And and maybe because I've just been so conditioned to it, like Jamie, I was like, okay, I know this top, you know, we're going to get to this and that, whatever. But it was so clean. It was so honest. And it's, you know, some people in terms of the war on drugs want to focus on prevention. Some want to focus on prevention. Interdiction. Some want to focus on punishment. Some want to focus on the countries that are producing the poppy, the et cetera, these kinds of things, whatever. You know, and the honest answer is it's a comprehensive approach, et cetera. But David, what surprised you the most? We've talked about this before in the context of something that goes on in D.C., the general topic. But what surprised you the most, if anything, when you were reading the drafts?
Well, what was illuminating to me, and I told Anne this, is, you know, my privilege, frankly, at being born in this country at the time I was born in this country and the sacrifices that so many people made so that my life could be a little bit better in this country has shielded me from the idea and the notion that physical pain is how a lot of people on this planet go through their lives, their entire lives, or a great portion of their lives is spent in physical pain.
Yeah.
And for that reason, and Anne goes into this in great detail in the book, is people took opium. They didn't take opium to get high. They took opium to relieve pain because in the 1800s, there was no anesthesia. There was no way to do an operation that
there
would,
was no
would
aspirin.
Be painless. So you didn't have an operation. So you had to deal with this pain that you had that you couldn't do anything about. You couldn't have an operation. So you took opium to ease the pain. And so I think one of the things that was illuminating to me was drug use in the main. Now, there is certainly has evolved over the past century, but drug use in the main was to solve for pain.
Mm-hmm.
And if until we understand that, I don't know how we can understand how to deal with it in any type of meaningful way, because it's always these people do this to get high. Some of them do, but most of them do it because something's hurting. They want to stop hurting.
And Anne, let me ask you something about that. There's different kinds of pain. There's physical pain. There's mental, emotional pain, right?
Yep.
It's all in the same category.
Yeah. I mean,
it's a chicken or egg kind of thing. Are more people using drugs to alleviate pain? You know, which comes first?
Right.
Is it the pain itself and they're going to find some relief, David? Or is it that's there and so it's an easy hop?
I think what I would say is that the people who have no pain of physical or psychic nature, when they try drugs, they will only try them and then they will not get addicted to them.
Uh-huh.
And it's the people for whom it fulfills a need are the people who will get addicted to it.
Right.
Because like in the 80s, the drug statistics of people who grew up in the 80s, it might be a familiar cohort for some of us. Almost everyone used drugs at some point in the 80s. If you grew up in the 80s, you used drugs almost assuredly. Not that many of them became addicted.
Yeah. So what's different now?
Well, it's also not very many. The problem of now is some of the drugs that people use can have such devastating effects because they're so much stronger.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So we always have this sort of moral panic about new drugs, right? Meth, take it one time and you're hooked. Crack, take it one time and you're hooked. That's rarely the case. But if you have fentanyl, you can easily take not to get hooked, you won't get hooked, but you could die or you could have a serious overdose. And you won't have intended that at all. It's so powerful.
Jamie, go.
The big question for me is so is the war on drugs, and I'm making air quotes with my fingers. You can't see that on the radio.
On News Channel 8, they can see it.
Is it a failure?
Great question.
Yeah, that's a good question. I would say that it is not a success. In that we continue to have 100,000 people dying and hundreds of thousands of people who are addicted. And then around the world, we continue to have all these other people. So I would say it's not rational the way that we actually choose to fight it. But I would also say that it's likely that it, if we have nothing, if we have no efforts to get to control drugs, more people would take them.
So again, just drawing on my own life experience, I've known, I have a close friend whose daughter died from an overdose, which was early in the fentanyl, in the introduction of fentanyl into the thing. We don't know for sure that it was fentanyl that killed her, but
probably
I knew that. Yeah. I also have firsthand knowledge of kids who were slammed with drug distribution charges, with very heavy penalties that, you know, knowing the circumstances, I'm not sure were totally justified, but whatever. And right. then they got into the what they call the school to prison pipeline. Even if they don't go to prison, they have a conviction right. and they can't get certain jobs, and then they end up going back yeah. into the
cascading effect
cycle yeah. because yep. that's the way they can make money.
Yep.
And for that reason, I've always favored the decriminalization or legalizing of marijuana, because I've seen so many, I have firsthand knowledge of kids who got involved in that. And as you said, everybody takes drugs at some point. I'm talking to you now as I'm drinking a glass of Cabernet Sauvignon.
Exactly.
Nice.
And it can just, it can derail and ruin lives, and for that yep. reason alone. But I also am concerned about the prevalence of people using marijuana and drugs and what effect that would have. So, as you said, it's not an easy answer. So where does that leave us?
Can I pile on before you answer, Anne? This is what fascinates me.
It's your show. Go ahead.
Not really. It's Claude's show. Let's be honest. The four of us could disappear and Claude could more than capably carry it on. No, I just, you know, I think visually, and I keep, Anne, with your book, I just keep thinking, boy, she took a 360-degree view around this and how this stuff cascades.
Yep.
And I learned a little bit about this in other contexts. Doesn't matter. But this, you know, money matters. And by that, I mean, if I were an 18-year-old right now and I got busted for, you know, what, too much pot or something like that, whatever, my parents would hire some stupid lawyer and the lawyer would like immediately expedite this and that, whatever. And I do some community service. Boom. Life goes on.
Yep.
Majority of people who get grabbed for that don't have that ability. And so then, Jamie, to your point, they get brought in and sucked up in the legal system in a way that's far exceeds their crime, if you will. The cascading effect of some of this is just phenomenal. Yeah. So it's not just the war on drugs per se. It's all these offshoots that just grow like topsy crazy, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, the war on drugs just fits in with all, that's kind of the 360 image is very nice because it kind of fits into all the societal issues, right? So
yes. race,
class, the environment, you know, the way we've chosen to fight it harms the environment. And it, so it slots into all of those things. So we can't really solve the war on drugs unless we're addressing these other issues.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, we don't want to have it so that everybody can sell fentanyl, you know, over the counter. Like, that's not going to be a good solution. So there's going to be laws and people are going to break those laws. Like, that's mm-hmm. the nature of law. People break them. So, right. so, but not making sure that people don't get caught up in this when it's just an innocent exploration.
Right.
But that they do, and they do in, too, right? You know, you can drive your car too fast, just like reckless teenage boy drives his car too fast and cause an accident, and then his life is also wrecked forever.
Yeah. So. But and again, to your point, it's so multifaceted, and it has so much to do with, you know, economic ability,
yeah.
as much as anything else. Jamie, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
So you write about Nancy Reagan and her just say no.
Right.
To drugs. It sounds like a positive message. Was that a positive message? Just mm-hmm. say no.
Good questions tonight, Jamie. Good questions.
Well, I mean, so it's at some level, sure. Except just say no is a binary, right? So if you don't say no, then you say yes. So as soon as you decide to, I'm maybe not going to say no today, then you've said yes. And then, oh, now I'm a drug user. So that's what this the research shows about the sort of Just Say No campaign and the DARE campaign, which I don't really talk about, but some of us may remember that kids would either completely adhere to it, but if they took one step off of it, then they go, oh, now I'm a drug user. And then they would just feel free to use drugs because they had not said no, they had said yes. So it's kind of wiser to say, you know, you can say like something a little bit less dramatic than no, just say no, that allows them to
most of the time
come back. Yeah, right. Generally, no.
Yeah, generally. But there are exceptions.
The 21-year-old threshold, I thought that was a pretty good one.
Well, part of the problem is, of course, in popular culture, in any movie that you watch, people are doing drugs all the time. I remember watching the movie. I can't even remember the name of the movie. It had Steve Martin and Meryl Streep and they're older people. And they,
you know, it's like, complicated. They find a joint. The name. Yeah. Isn't it? It's complicated. Is that the one?
It's complicated.
Yeah.
That wow. No
they find a joint.
Which it most certainly
and
is.
They go off and smoke it behind a bush and then they're silly. And it's just portrayed as something that, you know, like, well, people do, and it's not a big deal as long as you don't get caught. And, you know, you don't get caught unless you're, you know, a minority. That's basically.
Yeah, well, they get treated a little differently when they get caught.
We did differently. Definitely. We did differently, which is addressed in this fabulous book. And, Anne, one of the things I loved about it, again, you didn't miss you didn't miss anything. It's kind of reading, going, okay, this is good, it's good. And of course, I'm annoying my husband going, did you know? And I'm just, you know, reading him stuff out loud. Heroin chic.
Yeah.
You know, the war on drugs, drug culture had an impact on so many elements of society at every level. And society had an impact. Heroin chic was a thing. Can you talk about that and how you talked about it in the book?
Yeah. So in the late 80s, early 90s, there became this sort of fashion models and like Kurt Cobain and all of that sort of, they were taking heroin or they were making themselves look like they took heroin. So I wanted to use one of the photos, but I couldn't afford the permissions from these fashion models.
Right.
where they, you know, the models became very thin. They wore the baggy kind of ripped clothes. They put dark circles
dark
under their eyes on purpose with bright red lipstick to sort of contrast with the pallor of their face to look like a heroin addict.
Yeah.
Lifted up as this kind of model. And it was part of that whole sort of grunge thing as well. It's a sort of, that was considered sort of fashionable then.
The cool thing to do. It was the cool thing to do. Okay, so
I mean, cocaine was equally associated with fashion, right? In the 70s and the early
80s, sure.
Okay, David first, then Jamie.
Yes, I just want to say.
David, so far, Jamie's had really good questions.
He's had excellent questions. It's been outstanding.
So far.
So Anne, I wanted you to speak a little bit, because we talked about it briefly, about the environmental impact, because this speaks right to the notion of interdiction does not interdiction harms the environment.
Right. It does.
Of the place that's being interdicted. And then it moves to someplace else where when you put the infrastructure in place to either grow or sell or distribute drugs, it also hurts the environment.
Yeah.
So no matter what you do, it hurts the environment. So could you speak to that?
I mean, it was funny because just the other day on NPR, they had a story and they were talking about illegal mining and foresting. And they're like, oh, it's the drug cartels that are doing this illegal mining and foresting in various parts of Central America.
Did you watch Ozark? You would have known that if you had watched Ozark.
So I mean, everything that they do to try and hide it and just the actual literal interdiction where they're trying to eradicate the drugs, spray them or whatever, that harms the environment. But then also because people have to try to hide their production, their growth and production. So they go into increasingly remote places and that itself destroys the environment with deforestation and the use of pesticides, but then they don't have proper, even silly things like they don't have a way to take out their trash. So they just dump trash everywhere. Right. That happens in the United States too, where there's marijuana grown illegally.
Yeah.
And they still have to hide it. You know, the federal government can still come
in. Schedule one, right?
Yeah.
Which is insane.
In Oregon, my family, some of my family's from Oregon, there's a lot of stealing of electricity and water for marijuana farms because they can't get water. There's no water distribution. It's all federally, water is distributed by federal policies for irrigation. And so people have to steal the water.
Okay, I've got an idea, kids. The idea is this: turn the 20-somethings against drugs, telling them about the environmental damage.
Yeah.
Come on.
I think it's true. It's true that they think it's very natural. And I know some 20-somethings. I'm related to some. So
we have never done any drugs whatsoever. Now
one lives in the Netherlands and one lives in Massachusetts. So I'm going to probably guess that.
Yeah. Okay.
So I'm a big fan of CBS Sunday Morning because it's geared to people of my age. And one of the things, the regular features on CBS Sunday Morning is they profile aging rock or pop stars, and they do a profile, and it's always fascinating.
Yeah.
And invariably, these people talk about their drug phase.
Sure.
They got involved in drugs,
right.
What it did, and how they overcame it, and now they're doing okay. And so, you know, it's almost like it's a rite of passage. And of course, the people they don't profile because they're not around anymore is the ones who didn't make it through the drug phase.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if you have a question.
Go ahead. No, jump.
Funny story about that. So we were reading about something about the drug users with my students, and one who's a nurse, she's working as a nurse and going to school. She works in a nursing home, and she said they're having a real problem because people are coming into nursing homes. So people older than you, maybe. And when they come in, they go through withdrawal because they can't get their regular recreational drugs they've been taking since the 1960s.
Wow.
When they go into the nursing home. And so, but they don't want to tell anyone. So they're going through withdrawal, but not confessing this to the doctors. And well, she said, it's a problem.
We treat this like it's like a terrible moral and a defect,
right?
And a really bad decision. But yet, so many people. But on the other hand, we kind of even joke about it in popular culture, and we recognize it when we see, you know, people profiled in their 60s, 70s, or sometimes even 80s who had a drug phase in their life. And just for the record, I've never engaged in any of these drugs except alcohol, which is a drug, by the way.
Yeah, it is.
You know, I do drink beer and wine. And so in that respect, I guess I'm a normal American, but I also recognize that it's not the healthiest thing to do.
Yeah.
But
although on the harm scale, alcohol is much more harmful than marijuana, actually.
Okay, but you're not going to convince me to switch to marijuana.
I'm not trying to.
Part of my life.
Part of the harm scale is behavior, so it's much more likely to cause violence and aggression. Alcohol is than marijuana.
On the other hand, marijuana, since it's been legalized or decriminalized in much of the area, now you smell it everywhere.
That's
Am I
true.
Wrong about this?
No, but you're
in traffic and you smell it. You walk by somebody's house, you smell it.
Not in Indiana, but
no, yeah.
Oh my gosh, downtown DC, absolutely. Go around Capitol.
It's completely illegal in Indiana. So.
You're thinking like Is that a skunk? Oh no, that's somebody with some particular.
Well, correct. Yeah, I was going to say. I mean, I'm in New York working the U.S. Open this past summer, and the biggest story was all the weed smoke.
Yes, and weren't some of the players, Claude, complaining about it?
Yes, yeah,
because they're so focused on their health and everything else.
Right,
right. Okay, Ann, let's get you out of this before we subject you to the incredibly embarrassing 60 seconds more. I think it'll be interesting coming from her, David. Please.
Yes. No, I agree. I'm curious. Okay.
It's a really unfair question, but I'll ask it anyhow. So again, the 360 degree way in which you approach this, there are so many things, and people want to punish, they want to prevent, they want to interdict, etc. If you rule the world, let's just say you ruled the United States, and by the way, there's still time. You could get into the presidential campaign.
David's supposed to run for president, and I'm supposed to be Secretary of State. I've said this to her for 40 years.
When she runs, I just want to be her press secretary. That's all.
No. You were supposed to run, and I was going to be the Secretary of State. That was the deal.
Oh, that's true. Good point. You were going to be the Secretary of State.
Either one works for me. So one of you wins. Because right now, the field is wide open. But Anne has to answer.
I would be very young in the field, so that's
yeah.
If you had to focus on one of those things to constructively, I know if it's unfair, just say go away. But if you personally could only focus on one aspect of constructively addressing this problem, which aspect would it be?
The one I would do first, I think, is decriminalization of a certain class of drugs by strength and getting all the people convicted of those drug crimes out of prison. That's first.
Yeah, I think that's a good one. I like that one a lot. Okay. All right. It's Anne Foster. The book is The Long War on Drugs. It's really good, everybody. It's just, you know, it's going to lift your spirits at the holiday time. It's a great gift.
It makes you smarter.
It does have a lot of fun facts,
as you said. Like
It does.
Fact-based reporting.
Yes,
we have so little of these days.
Did I tell you about her? Did I tell you?
You did. You're absolutely right. It makes you smarter. It was just one of the most, I was about to say enjoyable. That's the wrong word. But it's one of the most rewarding things to read in a long time.
Eye-opening.
Yeah, thank you. That's why you're journalists.
Hey, Chatterheads, it's Jamie here with a couple of quick items before you go. First of all, thanks so much for listening. We really appreciate your time. There are, however, a few things you can do to help us keep Chatter chugging along. Of course, you can follow us in all the usual places, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Join us on Patreon for bonus outtakes from the show, including Tori's rapid-fire lightning round with the guest and some pre- and post-show persiflage that we usually edit out. Go to chatteronbooks.com to subscribe to our monthly newsletter where you'll get a sneak peek at the upcoming authors. And don't forget, if you're buying books, please try bookshop.org. It's easy, it's online, and the best thing is you'll be supporting your favorite independent bookstores and affiliates like Chatter on Books. So download us wherever you get your podcasts. Give us a review on Apple if you're feeling so disposed. But, you know, most importantly, just stay in touch. Send questions, comments, ideas, and even insults to info@chatteronbooks.com. That's info@chatteronbooks.com. And thanks again for listening. Stay safe. We'll see you next time.
And your book is great, The Long War on Drugs. And seriously, everybody should go get a copy of this book. You will feel better about yourself. You will feel smarter. David, closing words?
I don't have to say anything else. It's all there. It's all there. I always think every historian should have on their card, well, actually.
No, historians, what we always say, it started earlier than you think, and it's more complicated than you think.
Right.
I do think you kind of like raced over the title, The Long War on Drugs.
That's right.
And no subtitle, which is a big...
No subtitle. Doesn't say a novel.
No subtitle.
Yeah, a novel.
Bless you. Novels drive us crazy and drive me crazy because it's, you know, some cool name like, you know, The Sunset Crowd, a novel. Thank you. I think I need that. And nonfiction, there usually is some incredibly painful, long subtitle.
Yes.
It actually was a matter of an hour-long meeting, though, amongst the marketing staff at Duke.
Of course.
Whether we could not have a subtitle.
I think it works fine. And the cover is great. If you buy the book, it's a fabulous cover. They did a great job with it.
And being the visual person, the illustrations are great, which I know is also a battle with publishers. So God bless you for doing that.
Speaking of subtitles, I think...
Speak quickly, Jamie.
For Chatter on Books, your subtitle should be something like Your Golden Ticket to the Best of List. You know, so when you're appealing to authors, they if you appear on Chatter, you're going to be on that list.
Right, I certainly hope so.
Getting very close. Claude, thank you for doing all the important work.
Thank
David,
you.
Of course.
Always good to see you, my friend. Go Eagles. How are the Eagles doing?
Not so great, but that's okay.
Love him. Jamie, thank you. Thank you. Be nice to the grandchild. If she wants to be a cat, she gets to be a cat. And Anne, thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
Yeah. Fabulous. Everybody stay well. And thank you, everybody, for listening. And we'll see you next week.